We're going to be in Daniel chapter 8 this morning. We've been walking through Daniel for a few weeks now, and we are in chapter 8, which is part of the second section of Daniel, which is prophetic. And so, as I said last week, you know, it's a little bit different because we're not in the narrative section, the part that maybe you may visit a lot with Daniel in the lion's den and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace and dreams and floating hands and all the narrative, right? That's behind us. And so now we're looking at prophecy. I want to start with the big idea. Would you go ahead and put the big idea up there? So this is where we're headed. I just want you to see this, and then we'll kind of keep going with some explanation. The big idea is very simple, and I just want you to have this rattling around in your brain as we kind of move forward, okay? God's word prepares us to persevere in suffering because his hand, will ultimately prevail. God prepares us. God's word prepares us to persevere in suffering because his hand will ultimately prevail. We saw a dose of that last week in Daniel 7. We'll see more of that in Daniel 8. But as I said a moment ago, this genre is unique. It's different. It's the prophetic genre. And I'll just be honest with you, I'll say the same thing I said last week. This isn't a strength of mine. I mean, I have focused a lot on Paul's letters and the Gospels and Old Testament narrative even I'm getting there with. This is not really my strength. This is end time stuff. And I'll just confess that, like, this isn't a strength. I've studied this passage a lot, don't get me wrong. But I say that to say this, that, like, if you're coming thinking that you're going to hear me preach a commentary that answers all your questions, I just wanted to say that that's not really the aim of preaching the book of Daniel to answer all of our questions. In fact, we looked at last week that Daniel didn't even have all of his questions answered when looking at this vision that he had from God. And so our goal as we look at chapter 8 is not to uncover every nook and cranny and land on perfect interpretation of every single symbolism that you'll find. We're going to do our best and we'll find some really neat things here. But here's our goal. The goal is to identify Daniel's meaning, Daniel's purpose in writing, and then apply that purpose to our present circumstances in our own, today, modern Babylon. It's a godless world that we live in. And there's a word for us the same way that there was a word for Daniel and for the people that he served in his time. And so I'll just say that not all of our questions are going to be answered. And so instead, we're going to preach sort of a big sweeping meaning and arrive at why it matters for you and for me today. Now, one of the things I mentioned last week is that the end of chapter 7 ended a long section from chapter 2 all the way to chapter 7, which was in the language of Aramaic. Aramaic was the language of the world. And so God's people were exiled in Babylon away from their home. And that was because of that was punishment for their wrongdoing. And God sent them into exile. Daniel's writing a hopeful word, but he's also writing this Aramaic section, not just for Hebrew speakers, the Israelites, but really it's for the Babylonians to read. He wants them to read this and see that my God is greater than your God. There's no king that rivals my God. And so it's sort of a gospel tract, if you will. Now, chapter 8, all the way through the end of the book, now goes back to the language of the Hebrews. And the reason I say that, and the reason that's significant is this, that now Daniel's tone is going to shift. Whereas the Aramaic section was outwardly focused at a new audience, this part revisits God's people. It's inwardly focused on God's people, and that's why I put the big idea that says he is asking them, calling them to persevere, to keep going because the world is against them. You see, Israel had been oppressed. They had been enslaved. You think about Egypt. They'd been mistreated, many persecutions just by living in their region, the promised land. They'd also been exiled to Babylon. But a time unlike any that Israel had ever seen before was coming. Daniel gets this vision of a scary, scary reality that's coming for God's people that they had never seen before. Under Greek rule and the oppression of a man named Antiochus Epiphanes, which we're going to talk about this morning, one commentator talks about Antiochus Epiphanes' reign and this period of time for the Israelites, for the Jews. And he says that this guy instituted a systematic program designed to eradicate completely every trace of Israel's faith, worship, and life. They had not really experienced that before. And so God gives this prophecy to Daniel 400 years before these events are going to take place because they needed to be forewarned of what was coming. Why? The same reason you give anybody a warning, to prepare them. This is coming. It's a warning. Get ready. It's like when you're on a road trip. I think I've used this example before. You're on a road trip and you're taking two different vehicles and somebody's far ahead of you and then they call you and say, hey, speed trap coming up. Just want you to be ready. You don't want that call after you're past it, right? You want it before because that's when you want a warning. And so God is giving this warning to his people saying, there's something coming, and you need to be prepared for it. They would need to be reminded that they can faithfully press on and persevere, knowing, this is so important, that God's hand will ultimately prevail over evil. Still true, by the way, today. You see, there are times in life that it feels like, and maybe you can identify with this, there's times in life that it feels like evil is winning. But Daniel 8 is our reminder of the truth when that feeling comes over us, that evil cannot prevail over the plans of our God. It's true of their world then, it's true of our world now, and for the world forevermore. Let's look at this together. Daniel chapter 8, we're going to start in verses 1 and 2. We'll have the verses on the screen behind me. We're going to walk through this text pretty quickly, okay? It says, in the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, so this is 2 years after the vision we looked at last week, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after that which appeared to me at the first. And I saw in the vision, and when I saw, I was in Susa, the citadel, which is in the province of Elam. And I saw in the vision, and I was at the Ulai Canal. So what's happening here is that Daniel is really in Babylon, but he has this vision in Susa, which is a couple hundred miles away. And so clearly Daniel is seeing something that's not actually in front of him, but he sees it as if it is real. So I want to quickly read through the vision, and then there's going to be an interpretation given by an angel named Gabriel. Maybe you've heard that name before. An angel named Gabriel is going to give the interpretation later, but we're going to read through the vision, and we'll spend more time on the interpretation at the end, okay? Look at verses 3 and 4. And by the way, if you're waiting for like main points or anything like that on the screen, we'll get there towards the end, okay? Verse 3 enforces this. I raised my eyes and saw, and behold, a ram, this is the vision, standing on the bank of the canal. It had two horns, and both horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher one came up last. Verse 4, I saw the ram charging westward and northward and southward. No beast could stand before him. And there was no one who could rescue from his power. He did as he pleased, and he became great. So this is what he sees, this huge animal, this ram, and it's doing what a ram does. It's just charging and charging and charging. And I don't know about you, but I don't want to stand anywhere close to a ram that's charging because that would hurt like crazy. And this is the exact image that is being painted. Have you ever seen a ram something? You ever wonder where you get the word ram from? It's from ram, right? Because they have a reputation of ramming things, and they do it without any hesitation, and they bowl over whatever's in their path. This is the image that Daniel's giving us, and they're ramming like crazy. 5. And as I was considering, so he's thinking about it, he's like, what in the world am I looking at? Behold, a male goat came from the west across the face of the whole earth without touching the ground. So it's flying, basically. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between its eyes. I mean, it's very visible. It's protruding. He came to the ram with the two horns, which I had seen standing on the bank of the canal. And he ran at him in his powerful wrath. I saw him come close to the ram. And he was enraged against him and struck the ram and broke his two horns. And the ram had no power to stand before him. And he cast him to the ground and trampled him. And there was no one who could rescue the ram from his power. I want you to see this image. Again, I like to put these images up there. It's a black and white image of just sort of an artist rendition of what this may have looked like, right? And again, who even knows? I mean, but it's a dream. You ever have a dream and you're like, what in the world just happened? That didn't make any sense. But when I was dreaming, it made sense. Who even knows what this looked like? But we have a pretty good description. You have this huge ram and has a reputation of laying down everything in its path as it rams through everything. And then you have a goat that comes from the west, and it says it was coming with such veracity that it didn't even touch the ground. I mean, it was going so fast and so hard that he saw it. It's like he saw it coming over the horizon, flying in the direction of the ram. And it says that protruding horn took down the ram. It says it trampled at his feet. It destroyed it. This goat destroyed this ram. Look at verse 8. Then the goat became exceedingly great. But when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Notice it says, when he was strong, at the peak of his strength, the great horn was broken off. And instead of it, there came up 4 conspicuous horns toward the 4 winds of heaven. So the big horn on the front breaks, and it becomes 4 horns, 9 through 14. Out of one of them, one of the 4 now, came a little horn which grew exceedingly great. So it started little and then it grew bigger and bigger and bigger. It sounds a lot like what we looked at last week in Daniel 7, a small horn that grew bigger and bigger and bigger, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the glorious land. That's to the land of Israel. It grew great, even to the host of heaven. And some of the host and some of the stars it threw down to the ground and trampled on them. What an image to see, right? It became great, even as great as the prince of the host. Now, this is important. It says, and the regular burnt offering, remember, it grew toward the promised land, toward Israel. The regular burnt offering was taken away from him. This is now talking about temple, the temple. And the place of his sanctuary, the temple, was overthrown. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of the transgression. And it will throw truth to the ground. And it will act and prosper. Notice it will succeed in throwing truth to the ground. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to the one who spoke, for how long is the vision concerning the regular burnt offering, the transgression that makes desolate, and the giving over the sanctuary and host to be trampled underfoot? How long? And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings. Then the sanctuary shall be restored to its rightful state. To do the quick math there, that's a little over 6 years. And depending on how you read it, it could mean half of that time, but I'm not going to get into the details there. This is several years that he's talking about, that this horrible thing's going to happen for a few years, and then it's going to be restored to what it was before. Look at verses 15 through 17. That's a crazy vision, right? It says, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision, I sought to understand it. And behold, there stood before me one having the appearance of a man. And I heard a man's voice between the banks of the Ulai, and it called, Gabriel, make this man understand the vision. So he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was frightened, and I fell on my face. But he said to me, understand, O son of man, that the vision is for the time of the end. Now, I'm going to pause there for just a second. Every single commentary that I read, I wanted to know what it meant by for the time of the end. And every commentary that I read, which is four or five or six or so, it said that the end there is not talking about the end of all time, but instead it's talking about God's appointed time, some sort of an end that's a long way off. Now, the reason I say that is because I'm going to get to the end here about what he's getting at, is that 400 years from now, when this is being written, we're going to see these things come to fruition. They're going to come to pass. And we're about to hear why it's so clear that he's talking about 400 years from this. And so Gabriel is comforting Daniel. He says, basically, he's just saying, hey, look, Daniel, don't freak out. This isn't for right now. This isn't for now. Hold on. That being said, the themes of this end, which again is 400 years from now, I'm going to say that they echo all the way really to the end of the end, the end times. And so we're going to see that this is talking about a specific point in history, 400 years in advance or forward from what Daniel's writing. However, this certainly has application that echoes today. It echoed in Jesus' time, it echoes today, and it echoes into eternity. And if I've confused you, let's just keep going and maybe we'll be more confused. No, we'll see something in a second, okay? Look at 18 through 22. I think this is going to make sense. And when he, that's Gabriel, had spoken to me, I fell into a deep sleep with my face to the ground. But he touched me and made me stand up. He said, behold, I will make known to you what shall be at the latter end of the indignation. For it refers to the appointed time of the end. Notice an appointed time. God is the one that is establishing this. As for the ram that you saw with the two horns, here's why we know it's 400 years in advance. These are the kings of Media and Persia. And the goat is the king of Greece. And the great horn between his eyes is the first king. As for the horn that was broken, in place of which four others arose, four kingdoms shall arise from his, that's the Greek king's nation, but not with his power. This is making so much sense. If some of you guys are history buffs, you're going to say, you may even know exactly what he's talking about. And let's talk about this for a second. First of all, I love that they don't leave us wondering. Gabriel says this is about, this ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire, which we've talked about really for the past few weeks. Would you put that map up there about the Persian Empire? Now, you know it maybe more as the Persian Empire. This is the big one with lots of green. Do we have that? Yep, there we go. You notice that it says Media. Here we go. Well, I haven't used this in a while. Remember when we used to do maps all the time? So there's Media and there's Persia, but this is known as the Persian Empire because the Persian aspect of it was far greater than the Median aspect of it. Notice how large the Persian Empire swelled. There are movies about the Persian Empire. One of the most notoriously is 300. If you've watched the movie 300, that's the Persian Empire. And the Bible talks a lot about you. I mean, it's really neat that this is not a fiction. This isn't a fairy tale. This intersects perfectly with history. And the Persian Empire was enormous. And notice that this is the ram that charged westward and northward and southward. It became enormous. By the way, it says that it had two very large horns, but one was higher than the other. Did you hear that? As I said, the Persian aspect was greater than the Median aspect. And so I think what it's saying here is very clearly, it is talking about Media and Persia, that the Persian part is higher than the other. By the way, do you remember last week if you were here, I mentioned that I believe that the bear is the Median Persian Empire. It said that the bear was higher on one side than the other. Do you remember that? Again, I think that we're seeing a parallel to the Persian Empire there as well. The Persians, by the way, used the ram as they marched into battle. I don't mean that physically, although that may be possible. Instead, they used it as sort of like an insignia. They used it on art. They used it on royal seals. It would be like a battle logo. If anybody is a Star Wars fan, like the Rebel Alliance uses a phoenix that rises from the ashes as a rebellion. They use sort of images to sort of depict the significance of their military. And Persia did this. They used a ram as an image to depict what it was that what they were all about. And what did they do? They rammed, right? They just marched over everybody in ferocious power, charging west, north, and south. And it says that they became great. And Gabriel says, we're talking about Medes and Persians. Now let's talk about the goat for a second. The goat is not the Persian Empire, but instead the Empire of Greece, okay? This is Alexander the Great. He is the great king that it's referring to. Anybody know what I'm talking about? Alexander the Great. Very notorious. My little brother's middle name is Alexander. After Alexander the Great, he's okay. He's not that great, but hey, no, I love my little brother. It says that the Grecian Empire was so ferocious and powerful. It compares it to a goat that's not even touching the ground. It's just flying across from the west. Now, obviously, you see that the Greece would be over in this direction. It even says territories of the Hellenistic League. That's another word for the Grecian League. And so it charges from the west. My laser pointer just died. Charges from the west, flying from the west with ferocity. Again, now, this swift attack and this swift rise to greatness is perfectly depicting of Alexander the Great and his kingdom. They conquered the Persian Empire, which is why it says this big conspicuous horn took him down, broke the greatness, the horns of the Persian Empire. But it also says that that great horn, Alexander the Great, was broken. It says when he was still strong. It's like a historical commentary that's before the history happens. Yeah? Historical commentary before the history happens. Did you know that in Alexander the Great's life, at the peak of his power, which is exactly what it says, he died at the age of 33. He had a whole lot of greatness left in him, but he was cut down quickly. Exactly what it says would happen 400 years in advance. What does it say? It says that when the great horn was broken off, while he was still strong and dying at 33, it says that four horns rise in different directions, but not with Alexander and his empire's power. They were lesser than him. Put that other image up there if you don't mind, please. So these are those four empires, and you actually see five of them, and I'll explain why in just a second. So the four empires are the ones that you see behind me. The Alexander's kingdom was divided after his death into four parts, and the four different parts were his four greatest generals. After he died, again, 400 years in advance, it's exactly how it transpired. Alexander the Great died. This kingdom was divided into four parts, four generals. They took over, and none of them were as great as Alexander and the Greek Empire. Also, by the way, in chapter 7, I suggested that the leopard represents the Greek Empire. How many heads did that leopard have? Four, right? And I think that this is why. Just a thought. These four guys are Cassander over in the west part over there. West side? I didn't mean to say that. I'm sorry. Macedon and Greece were his parts over. It's really hard to pronounce this one, but Lysimachus, I'm probably butchering that, is up there. Ptolemy was down in the Egyptian area. But the most important one is the one off to the east. Notice it's very, very vast, and that is Seleucus. Seleucus is most of Syria and Babylon and stretches far, far to the east. And now the one that I skipped was Antigonus. He was squeezed out by the other four generals in Seleucia, sort of expanded where his is up there. It actually expanded into, so Cilicia even got larger as a result. Now, here's why I say all that, and I don't mean to put you to sleep with the map and all that stuff, although I think it's really fascinating. The reason this is important is because this is exactly what God says is going to happen before it happens. And especially significant is that there's one leader. It said that a horn came off of one of those horns. Did you see that? One horn, a little horn that became great, came off of one of them. And that unique king will rise from Seleucia. From Seleucia. So look at verse 23. Gabriel's going to give us a commentary on this little horn that becomes great from the place of Seleucia. Look at verse 23. And at the latter end of their kingdom, when the transgressors have reached their limit, a king of bold face. It's an interesting description. A king of bold face, one who understands riddles. He's smart, he's wise, he's crafty, shall arise. You ever heard someone say, that's a bold-faced lie? What do they mean by that? It's like unashamed. It's like proud and haughty and arrogant. This is the way that it describes this guy, this king that comes from Seleucia, is that he was bold-faced. He was sticking his chin out in his own wickedness. It says that he understood riddles, meaning that he was cunning. He could manipulate, and he was a controller of people. Scary, this guy was. We'll talk more about him in a second. Look at verse 24 and 25. It says, his power shall be great, but not by his own power. And I think that what Daniel's saying, or what Gabriel is saying here, is that he has demonic power behind him, backing. And he shall cause fearful destruction and shall succeed in what he does. Notice what it says. He causes fear. He destroys. He also succeeds in what he does and destroy mighty men and the people who are the saints. So believers, he'll tear them down. He'll kill them. Awful. By his cunning, he shall make deceit. So he lies, prosper under his hand. He succeeds in his lies. And in his own mind, he shall become great. Without warning, he shall destroy many. We'll stop there for just a moment. All right, look, a couple of things that I want to consider, because this is where we're really going to get to applying our text. What Daniel's getting at is that there's going to come a time when God's people are going to be severely endangered and threatened because this guy is going to rise from the Seleucian kingdom or empire, and he's going to mean business. He's going to do terrible things to God's people. Again, we're getting to the big picture here, right? Because God's given this prophecy to Daniel and saying, there is danger coming. You need to be forewarned about it so that you will know that I'm sovereign over it. I'm predicting it. So you know that when it comes to pass, it didn't happen unaware to me. It didn't happen, and so we don't know what we're going to do. No, God is sovereign over this, and so he needs his people to know he has a plan in the midst of it. And so the first thing that I want you to understand and leave with today is this, that evil's wins, number one, evil's wins are painful, but they ultimately serve God's purposes. Evil's wins are painful. And I put wins in quotes because they are wins, and yet eventually evil loses, right? Evil's wins are painful for God's people, but they ultimately serve God's purposes. It reminds me of Joseph, and I don't put this passage up there. I don't have it this morning in writing, but it's Genesis 50, verse 20, right? What you meant for evil, God meant for good. This is God's style. He purposes pain, even against his own people. So this horrible king, it says, is effective in terrorizing God's people. I mentioned these things a second ago, but it says that he worked with fear and destruction. He killed saints, God's people. He led with deceit. He used deceit that will be passed off as truth. He used lies and said, this is the truth. It's just like Satan's work, right? Did God really say? He's the father of all lies. It says that this little horn rises from one of the horns, and I think it's Seleucia. Go back to verses 11 and 12. Go back to the vision. It says, it, that's the horn, became great, even as great as the prince of the host. And I think that Daniel's referring to the high priest of Israel. So he became great. He had influence. And the regular burnt offering, I think that's why it's talking about the high priest. So the religious expression there was taken away from him, and the place of his sanctuary, that's the temple, was overthrown. It was desecrated. And a host will be given over to it together with the regular burnt offering because of transgression. And it will throw truth, this is the horn, will throw truth to the ground, and it will act and prosper. So who is it? Well, I believe that, again, theologians are virtually unanimous that this little horn is a guy named Antiochus IV Epiphanes. Antiochus the IV. Antiochus Epiphanes is what he is known in the history books as. Antiochus Epiphanes. Again, 400 years after Daniel wrote these things. By the way, though, the application of enemies of God's people and the horn thing from Daniel 7, it stretches way into the end times. But I think that we're talking about a specific guy, Antiochus Epiphanes. By the way, I keep saying his name because I really would like for you to remember it. Antiochus was his given name from birth. He gave himself this nickname, Epiphanes. You ever give yourself a nickname? Of course not. That's not what you do. Unless you're a super prideful, narcissistic, megalomaniac. And this guy was one of them. He gave himself this nickname, Epiphanes. And here's what it meant. It meant manifest. Specifically, God manifest. He thought himself a manifestation of the gods in the flesh. His enemies, again, Epiphanes would be that nickname, Antiochus Epiphanes. His enemies called him Epimenes, which sounds like it, but they're mocking it. It means madman. Even the enemies, the godless enemies, thought this guy was nuts. Archaeologists have discovered coins from this period of time, and I want you to see one of them. Would you put the image of that coin up there? It's hard to read. You wouldn't be able to read it if you could read it, because it's in Greek. But the picture on the left is his head. It's just a picture of his image. And on the right, it is Zeus on a throne holding a scepter. And if you were to read the Greek, here's what the Greek reads. King Antiochus, God manifest, bearing victory. He thought himself God, the God's representative on earth. And he, and I say this soberingly, no laughing matter, he fulfilled the 400-year-old prophecy given to Daniel by being a special kind of evil. And I want to tell you some of the things that he did. Brace yourself. Seriously. This is horrible. He outlawed Jewish religious rites, forbidding circumcision, which was a big one. He forbade Sabbath keeping. He forbid the observance of Jewish days of worship, the feasts. You know, the things that God instructed them to do. He forbid those things. He destroyed copies of their Bible, the Torah. He punished possession of God's word with death. He desecrated the temple in Jerusalem, really important building. If you're not really brushed up on Old Testament history, the temple was enormously significant. It represented the dwelling place of God among his people. Well, he desecrated the temple in Jerusalem in 168 BC. How did he do that? He built an altar to Zeus on the altar that was dedicated to God, and he sacrificed on that altar pigs, which was a big no-no. It was unclean animals, and God was very clear about that. Because God was clear about that, and because he knew it would drive them crazy, he took pigs and he dedicated it or sacrificed them on an altar dedicated to God and other unclean animals as well. He forced Jews to offer pagan sacrifices on those altars and eat unclean food, such as pork, and he would punish them if they refused. The punishment was death. He imposed worship of Greek gods on the Jews. He criminalized Jewish identity by making adherence to Jewish law a capital offense. Those who circumcised their sons, those who kept the Sabbath, those who held Jewish sacred books were immediately executed. He exacted brutal violence and mass punishment. He ordered his forces to slaughter many Jews. He would sell and ordered them to sell women and children into slavery. He robbed many families. He established a military garrison there in the temple square to dominate the city. He murdered tens of thousands of Jews and sold 40,000 Jews into slavery. I don't say this lightly, that he wanted to systematically wipe Judaism off the face of the earth. Does that sound familiar to anyone? Hitler wasn't the first one to try to do that. You know that name because it was recent. This is a name you should know. He horribly persecuted God's people. This is the little horn, I believe. I think it's very clear this is the little horn. Medes, Persians, the Greek, destroyed. One big horn breaks off, becomes four. One from the four of the Seleucid Empire. I think it's very clear who we're looking at here. We saw this little horn thing in Daniel chapter 7, that was the Antichrist to come. The little horn became big in Daniel 8. This one is this horrible man, Antiochus. bent on destroying God's people. But the reason I say that is this, that there's a broader theme here, and that is that there have been many, quote unquote, little horns that have become great throughout history. You could talk about Antiochus or Caligula, Nero, Stalin, Hitler, and as I said last week, we could even throw the people of Boko Haram in there that are seeking to genocide Nigerian Christians at this very moment in the name of Islam. Don't you understand? There have been many little horns that have become great over the years. And by the way, over the years, many have looked at those little horns that have become great and say, that's got to be Antichrist, got to be Antichrist, got to be Antichrist. Because the big point is, in many ways and at many times, evildoers are effective against believers. In many ways and at many times, evil will be seen winning. There will always be another little horn become great until the last one, which is the Antichrist. And I'm not just saying that. John said that in 1 John. We looked at this last week. 1 John 2, 18 says this. Children, it is the last hour, and as you have heard that Antichrist is coming, notice singular, he is coming. So now many Antichrists have come. He's using that generally. Therefore, we know that it is the last hour. He's saying there's one big bad that comes in the end, but there are many big bads that come before the end. And they're already here, and they're here now with us. Certainly. And they use the same tactic that we read about here. What did Antiochus do? The same thing that Satan has done. He uses fear against God's people and say, you bend the knee or else. Bend the knee to this movement or else. Forgive, give it up or else. He uses destruction. Haven't you seen the targeted violence against Christians over the years? He kills saints. I mentioned Nigeria. But listen, you've got church shootings and Christian school shootings that are happening at an alarming rate right now. Because there are many antichrists. I even noticed that it says they come for children. Do you notice that? They come for children. We live in an era right now where Satan is using lies and marring the truth to indoctrinate our kids. Same tactic. They try to ban the movement. That's what Antiochus was trying to do, ban the movement. Still happens. People try to push Christians into the margins of society and eliminate their thought, eliminate their impact. Antiochus tried to tarnish the word of God. Don't you see that in our culture, the mockery of the scriptures? It says that Antiochus used deceit and tried to pass off deceit as the truth. Isn't that a big one in our culture? Truth is relative. My truth, your truth, doesn't matter. There's no such thing as absolute truth. And so we can kind of just make this existence whatever we want it to be. And what a slippery, dangerous slope that is. But this is the enemy. And he's done this for a very long time. Antichrist is coming, but many antichrists have come and are coming. The biblical pattern, and this is hard pill to swallow. The biblical pattern and what Daniel is meant to see here and what we're meant to see is that they are successful in some ways. But only for a time. Only for a time. Look at the second half of verse 25 and then also verse 26. And he shall even rise up against the prince of princes. I think that this is God. And he shall be broken, but listen how he's broken, Antiochus, but by no human hand. Who's going to do it? God is. The vision of the evenings and the mornings that has been told is true, but seal up this vision, for it refers to many days from now. Verses 13 and 14 talked about this, that Daniel was shown that this terrible thing that's happening against God, people, has an end date. And it did. Antiochus would only be allowed to be effective for a time. At an appointed time, a certain amount of years, that time would end. And it happened exactly how God said it would happen. It says Antiochus will try to rival God, but it says no human hand will break him. God's hand broke him. It was fulfilled in 167 BC to 164 BC. This guy named Judas Maccabeus. You ever heard of the book of the Maccabees? This is kind of described there. Judas Maccabeus. Maccabeus means the hammer. So his name is literally Judas the Hammer. It's like a professional wrestler, right? It's a really intense name. This guy named Judas Maccabeus, the hammer, he led a revolt to victory and to the full restoration of their religion. So here's the question. Why this vision? I'm going to really let the rubber hit the road here, okay? The vision is given and explained by Gabriel for this reason, to prepare God's people for the times that evil seems to win. That in the face of great persecution, which will be felt severely, it's real, they and we must remember that God will eventually bring an end to it. Why? because God rules over pain for his purposes. God rules over pain for his purposes. I'll put it this way. Please listen. Every pain that you feel is real. As a believer, whether it be persecution or consequences for your own sin or being subject to just the fallen nature of this world, of its sickness and its death, every pain that you feel as a believer serves God's greater purposes. It serves to strengthen the faith of his people. It serves to surge the message of his salvation. It serves this purpose that when you face trials on every side, you can look beyond the trials to the one who will bring them to an ultimate end. We look to the one who gives peace in spite of pain. We look to the gospel, which means good news, that puts to bed every threat that the enemy could possibly conceive. So why then does evil win at times? Well, consider this. It's just a question. If you had every earthly good that you desired, would you ever look to the God who gave them to you? There is something about hurt, loss, suffering, pain. There's something about those things that causes our gaze to go upward. God purposes your pain for your glory or for his glory and for your good. Evil's winds are painful, but they ultimately serve God's purposes. The second thing is that in the face of great evil, it's okay to not be okay. I'll tell you what, let's look at verse 27. If you're writing, just pause for a second. We'll put it back up there in a second. Look at verse 27 with me. We'll put it back up there in just a second. Right after this vision, Gabriel, you know, gives him this hard truth. And it says this, and I, Daniel, verse 27, was overcome and lay sick for some days. He was sick over this. Then I rose and went about the king's business, but I was appalled by the vision, and I did not understand it. That's number two. In the face of great evil, like Daniel, it's okay to not be okay. It's okay to not be okay. What does it say about him? It says that he was sick and he was confused. He was sick and he was confused. And yet, you may have missed it, it says, after he was sick for a few days and still very confused, it says, but I got up, I rose, and I went back to doing the king's business. He got back to work. He was sick over the evil that he saw coming, and who wouldn't be? He saw it, by the way, had it explained to him by an angel himself, and he still didn't understand it. If you're ever frustrated because you read something in the Bible and you're like, I just don't understand, Gabriel himself appeared to Daniel and explained it, and Daniel said, it's still just not clicking for me, you know? My question for you is this. Are there times where the evil, the pain, the suffering, the loss, the death, the hurt are just too much for you? That's true for me. You see, Daniel felt this way. And I can only imagine the Jews who lived this fulfillment felt this way. I say this because of this. It is okay for you to be sick over the hurt. Some of y'all are there right now. And there's such an immense weight of pain in your life, and you're sick over it. The weight of the loss, the weight of the loneliness, the weight of the depression, the weight of the grief, the sadness, the weight of the worry, the weight of the anxiety. And you're there, and it makes you sick. It made Daniel sick to see the evil coming, and even had it explained to him. It didn't just suddenly zap away the hardship, the hard thing. It's okay to not be okay. Daniel wasn't fine with this. And I think we could even argue that in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus was sick over the pain to come, right? I mean, but hear this. This is so important. Despite that, true of Daniel, true of Jesus, after some days, it says Daniel rose and went back to work. After some hours, it says Jesus rose to do his Father's will. Why do I say that? Because there is a time for sorrow, and there's a time for grief, and there's a time for despair. But there is also a time to rise and trust in the Lord as you are going, not because of because the evil is gone, and not because you fully understand, but because you trust the one who will ultimately defeat evil and who has a purpose in the pain. Amen. That's why we can keep going. Not because it goes away, and not because we comprehend, but because we trust God. And in faith, we say, He's got it, even if I don't. No matter how great an empire or king may be, they are merely actors in a play written by someone greater. When God is done writing their story, they fade into history as the story and storyteller continue. Antiochus, you didn't even know who he was, perhaps. This guy made himself to be a God manifest, and he's forgotten. Because when God finishes writing their story, they disappear. I want you to hear me say this, that the problems that you face every day are real. But if God had in his palm the power of Alexander the Great and Antiochus Epiphanes and could humble them to nothing, why do you allow the problems in your life to feel insurmountable and too great for God to handle? Is he not greater than the hardship that you experience every day? Is he not greater than the pain? Is he not greater than the loss? Is he not greater than the worries? Is he not greater than that? He caused to disappear great kings. Could he not cause to disappear your far less great problems? So I think that a good application for this is here. It's okay to not be okay. It's okay to hurt. It's okay to ask questions. It's okay to not understand. It's okay to be really broken because of what you experienced. Daniel felt it. He didn't even live it, and he felt it. Not to mention the Jews that lived it 400 years later. But then, as there is a time for that, there is also a time to rise and trust and keep going. Why? Not because you reign, but because Jesus reigns. There's no kingdom, no power, no ruler who will ever rival him. And this is why Jesus said, I'm going to establish my church and the gates of hell will not be able to prevail against it. And as I've said before, if the gates of hell will not be able to prevail against God's people, neither will any lesser enemy. The Jews have this annual celebration. I mean, like even now, today, it happens here pretty soon. It's called Hanukkah. You ever heard of Hanukkah? The Jews have an annual celebration called Hanukkah. It's the celebration, by the way, of what I just described a moment ago, this time that Judas the Hammer, it's a celebration of his driving out of Antiochus and all of his hate. It's called Hanukkah. It means, the word Hanukkah literally translated as dedication. It's celebrated at the Festival of Lights, and they have all these lights that they bring up. It's a metaphorical reminder that darkness didn't win when Antiochus was reigning his terror. The darkness didn't win. So they have these huge lights. You probably see like the Jewish thing that's like a candlestick with candles that kind of go like that. You know what I'm talking about? Kind of does this. It has a name, and I'd probably butcher the pronunciation, but you know what's really cool about that? Check us out, man. Jesus was a Jew. He was a Jewish man, right? In John chapter 10, Jesus shows up at Hanukkah. Remember, he lived after Judas the Hammer laid down the hammer, okay? Jesus lived after that. Jesus, a Jewish man, living about 180, 90 years after this happened, he goes to the temple, which is where Judas the Hammer, again, did what the hammer does. Jesus shows up at the temple, and it's this huge festival. It's Festival of Lights. It's Hanukkah time. There's Jews everywhere, and they're celebrating the Festival of Lights. There's lights everywhere, huge lights. I mean, like bigger than these lights, huge lights, and they're celebrating that light beat out the darkness, and God did it. No human hand, right? And so here's what Jesus does in John 10. He stands up. Where everybody else, these priests and stuff have the attention over here. He stands up and he gets a crowd. He gets everybody's attention. I bet Jesus could yell so loud. He yelled so loud. And this is what I think happened. He says, actually, I know what he said. You want to hear it? I am the light of the world. That's when Jesus said that. He stood up and said, I am the, these lights, Judas the Maccabean, no, I am the light of the world. Just this past Wednesday, we're starting the book of John, and we mentioned that Jesus said, and John said about Jesus, he is the light of life. Why is that? Because when Jesus showed up, he was showing everyone, once again, that darkness does not win. That when he came, it was the death of death. When he came, Satan was reminded that he doesn't win this game. And it's amazing, right? The light of life, who is the reminder that darkness doesn't win. And can I tell you something? At the cross, Satan did his very worst to Jesus. And guess what? He succeeded. He did his very worst to Jesus, and he succeeded in seeing that Jesus was killed. But as a result, he simply brought to pass what God had planned from the beginning. Because God purposes our pain. And at the cross, it was determined, not by Satan, but determined by God, that he would pay for your sin and my sin, that we may not perish, but have everlasting life. Because he is the light of the world. And whatever darkness you're experiencing right now, I want you to understand that he can bring you through, and that Satan cannot prevail against what God has planned for your life.